From WXXI News, this is Education Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in England in 1621 when British scholar Robert Burton bemoaned the decline of interest in language and humanities. Burton wrote, quote, "In former times, kings, princes, emperors were the scholars, excellent in all faculties. But those heroical times are past. The muses now are banished," end quote. Banished! Fast forward to 1970. Poet and professor Reed Whittemore announced in the New Republic, quote, "English is going down the drain." But wasn't it supposed to have gone down the drain 3.5 centuries earlier? Well, the humanities have often been declared dead or dying, and by now the collective humanities might feel like that poor peasant in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Bring out your dead, the villagers are instructed, and there's the humanities slung over our shoulder, even though the humanities continues to insist, "I'm not dead yet, I think I'll go for a walk." But now there are new concerns, and this time we wonder if they're valid. Fewer women, for example, appear to be going into the humanities by many measures. Salaries, by some measures, are lower. In 1967, humanities enrollments in universities comprised 17.2% of all degrees. In 1987, it was down to 7%, according to the Atlantic Monthly. Today, it's somewhere between 6 and 7%. So is this the crisis we've long been hearing about? And how is higher education handling it? My guess for the hour. Thomas Slaughter is a professor of history at the University of Rochester, the author of a fabulous book called Independence, The Tangled Roots of the American Revolution, which we had a great conversation on last year. Researching, I'm told, a couple of books now as well. Is that right, Professor?
Yes, one related to my digital humanities project, which is about the Seward family of Auburn, New York, and the other about the first four presidents in retirement. I've considered calling it Founding Geezers, but I think it'd be something like Founding Grandfathers, maybe, something like that.
Well, nice to see you in person in the studio. Welcome back to Connections.
Thank you.
Joan Saab is here. She is a professor of art history and a chair of the department at the University of Rochester. She's the author of For the Millions, American Arts and Culture Between the Wars. And last time we talked, we were talking, was it a digital, it's a kind of a modern recreation of a Rochester monument going back 50, 60 years, the old rail station, right?
Yes, the Bragdon train station. And we're still, that was a wonderful conversation. And I think some of the things we talked about then might still be relevant in our conversation today about new ways of doing humanistic research in the 21st century.
Well, let me just ask both of you, and Joan, I'll start with you. Are the humanities in a crisis? Do you hear this every year, or every 6 months, or every 5 years, or is there a real crisis?
Well, I mean, the humanities, I went to college in the 1980s. I went to graduate school in the 1990s. And the humanities have been in crisis my entire academic career. But I do think it depends on what you mean by crisis. I think that the enrollments in the courses we teach at the River Campus at the University of Rochester are certainly in decline, but they were never huge. The students we have in the courses are engaged, they're intelligent, they're wonderful. And so I don't think humanistic inquiry and scholarship is in crisis. I think if you're the metrics that one uses have been slowly in decline, or you could say since the 1980s, they've been sort of leveled out. And if that's how you're measuring crisis, then certainly. I think the notion of crisis suggests a sort of forward-looking, you know, a moment of decision-making looking towards the future. And I think taking stock, there's a lot, and this is something we can talk about today, at stake in the notion of crisis. So yes and no. I think I'm dodging the question.
Well, no, but this reminds me of the debate about, is classical music dying? You know, for the people who say, well, you know, it doesn't get Britney Spears. No, look how outdated I am. Who's Taylor Swift? It doesn't get Taylor Swift ratings, right? But it never did. It's never going to be a 50% category,
right.
But it might be just healthy, just fine. And I see our engineer behind the glass, John Andrus, proudly holding up is that the RPO? That's the RPO season there. So I kind of see this parallel, John. Where we bemoan the death of classical music, but it's always going to be 3, 4, 5, 6% and not a 50% category. That doesn't mean you don't want it to be stronger or valued or appreciated, but it doesn't mean it's going to die.
Right. And I think the numbers that you gave a few moments ago, 17% was the sort of high point.
In the 1960s.
So that's, you know, that means, you know, there's still a lot of people not studying the humanities if you look at those numbers. So I do think that the notion of crisis, it's variable. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's certain things you can do from a position of crisis that can actually be really enriching and empowering. And that's the position that I try to take, because otherwise it's just, what can you do? You're paralyzed. We're in crisis. You know.
Well, Professor Slaughter, when we look at the way we even talk about the humanities, every different article I read seemed to be bringing in a sort of different metrics. What is the humanities to you?
The humanities is where you go as a student to learn about the commonalities and differences among people, whether that those differences are based in gender or race or culture or religion. It's where you go to learn critical thinking, where you learn how to write, how to communicate in ways that make you a person who has a richer life, a fuller life, and better tune and tolerance with the rest of the world. So there are crises in the world that need the humanities really badly. When I think of everything that hits the news in any given week or two, there are a lot of things that seem to me to be issues that need to be addressed through the humanities that can't be solved by science or medicine or other avenues that we have available to us in education, whether it's what just happened in Oklahoma with the fraternity, whether it's what's going on in the Middle East, where people are displaying immense levels of intolerance that expresses itself through violence, what has happened in Ferguson, Missouri, among other places. These are the things that we need to be talking about. We need to be providing avenues for exploration in through literature and art and music and history and all the other humanities. And yeah, I absolutely agree with you. There has been, as one article I read said, a 600-year death watch for the humanities. And yet still there are about 300,000 students who graduate each year with humanities degrees. We also know that English majors have a 2% lower unemployment rate than business majors right now. That can vary from year to year, and I wouldn't use that as an argument for the humanities. We know that mid-career English and history majors make more on average than business majors and engineering majors do. The big drop in the humanities, as you suggested, was roughly between 1970 and 1985, when it dropped from 17 to 7. There's a crisis for you for the humanities. It's dropped now from about 9% in 2009 to a bit under 7%, again, depending on the statistics you're looking at. Part of this, though, is not just a response to the recession of 2007, which is one thing that's called to mind often. It's also a response to, I think, some good news. The humanities have always been rich in women majors, but that's partly because other careers and other professions were closed off to women.
That's a fair point.
You move women around more into computer science, into business, into other professions, that's going to have an impact on the enrollments in the humanities too. But that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing.
No, that's a very interesting point, because from what I read and our guest can correct me if I'm wrong, but if you go back 40, 50 years, women outnumbered men in the humanities something like 2-1, and now it's just about parity. And what you're saying, Tom, is that may be perfectly healthy. We shouldn't necessarily bemoan that.
No, and so we've got right now, I think about 50, I saw a statistic said about 57% of college graduates right now are women. So we've had a rise since the 1960s in the number and percentage of women who are going to and succeeding in colleges. That's our mother load of majors going back to the 1970s, and we've got to share them.
Well, I see the phone's lighting up already, and so let me put out a call for humanities majors. Call the program and tell us about your experience. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We're going to get to some of your calls coming up, but first let me read a comment from Jake, who writes, I believe the humanities are critical for perspective in every field, but does there have to be a dedicated degree for it? Personally, I think they should be integrated into all college-level degrees. Is the depth of a full degree really what's important here? Let me start with Professor Slaughter. Go ahead. What do you think?
Absolutely not. I couldn't agree more. What we need is students taking humanities classes that are addressing the big questions in life and in human experience, that are helping you to see that it's not bad if you experience life differently than other people. Look at the way, you know, Van Gogh saw a starry night. Look at the way Monet saw a haystack. Look at the way that poets have seen the world, imagined the world differently. To celebrate the differences among human beings rather than to create defensiveness about what's me and what's you. So I absolutely think that, you know, what I want to do with the knuckleheads is not expel them from college. I want to get them in the classroom where we're talking about something other than accounting, in addition to whatever it is that they want to be doing as a career, as a profession.
Jim, what do you think?
Yeah, I fully agree. I think this idea of the humanities versus the other types of academic exploration is really silly, because everything is, as Tom pointed out, everything we do should be about answering questions and critical thinking, regardless of whether or not you're studying economics or whether or not you're studying medicine. So the humanistic questions, you know, what does it mean to be human? What have people done in the past? What do people in other parts of the world think about these things should be fully integrated in our explorations of everything we do. So yes, I agree with the comments that your listener brought up, because we do need to integrate humanistic inquiry into all fields, and separating them out as somehow or another distinct and separate from the rest of the world is in the rest of inquiry is really, I think, limiting what it is that we want to teach students and future mm-hmm. citizens of the world to do.
Professor Slaughter?
Yeah, we want to teach students that you enrich your life through art, through literature, through music, and that's apart from and related to your career choice. Doesn't have to be your career choice for it to matter. You'll be a better doctor or a better lawyer or a better accountant or a better banker for having these wider experiences. And finally, it's also, I like to think it's the humanities is a place where you can learn that you won't be more successful by choosing a particular career, but that you'll be more successful by figuring out who you are, what your talents and passions are, and by choosing the career that suits you. It's not more important to be one thing over another thing. It's really important for you to find the good match, the good niche, the place where you fit. And oftentimes, I imagine most of the time kids go to college not knowing who they are, what they want to do, what their life should be. But this is a place to explore those things, I think, whatever the outcome of that decision is, or however often it changes over the course of their lifetime.
Yeah, undeclared should be all in the humanities until they figure it out.
I absolutely agree.
See, when I was in school, college was a lot less. And so everybody was undeclared, and it was fun for a while, and then you figured it out. But now, if you're going to invest the money, start in the humanities. That is a good piece of advice. I like that. And here's Mark on Twitter. He writes, "My degree in linguistics has little obvious to do with my career in IT and communications, but it's not totally irrelevant. Has definitely had an impact on my understanding of communications and the structure of language." So Mark's saying, yeah, it's not perfectly applicable, but it definitely has a benefit. Joan, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I wanted to jump in. And something you said, that both of you said, I think is really important, this notion of success and that notion of fun, right? So the idea that I think that college now is seen as a route to a job and not necessarily as a place to take stock and to think and find pleasure in sort of the life of the mind. And I think that that's the sort of thing.
But
that
how do you measure that versus income, Joan?
Well, we are. I know. I mean, that's the question. And I think that now that the idea that a degree is linked to a vocation starts really young. I mean, it starts in high school. You know, they track kids in high school, and the educational system is changing. So these ideas about critical thinking and taking time to actually think, I mean, the idea that linguistics and IT are certainly linked. This idea that critical problem solving and the types of things you might learn in an English class or an art history class or a history class might actually help you, as Tom said, be a better lawyer or be a better or a physician, I think we need to reintegrate these things and teach people that you will find perhaps better job success if you're happier in your academic career. You'll get better grades if you're more engaged in what you're studying than if you think you have to do something in order to succeed. And I think that the people who enjoy what they do tend to be more successful at what they do.
All right, a couple of points here, and I am going to get to your phone calls because I see the phones have lit up, and I know Tom wants to jump back in. But let me at least do two things. I think we're, just to summarize, the phone's ringing again. All the humanities majors are calling the program today, which is great. To sum up, Joan, I think what you're saying is when we look at, well, if I major in the humanities and I'm stuck on the notion of what are the incomes, what are the projected incomes for every career in a certain field, it ignores the fact that you might not end up in a field that's perfectly related, but you will be better at what you do. You may appreciate it more. You may be a happier person. So it's a red herring just to lock into what career equals what income. I think it's fair, though all the starving artists out there are begging me to try to hammer you guys on they're the ones struggling the most, and we're going to get there because that is, I think it's a fair point here. But go ahead, Tom. I know you wanted to follow up.
Well, you know, one of the things that I say to people about now having taught for 30 years is that students, undergraduates, are magical creatures. When I started in my mid-20s, they were all about 20 years old. Now, 30 plus years later, they're still about 20 years old. And so I think of them as magical. It's amazing. You know, they've stayed there. I've moved on, obviously, the gray hair, which used to be brown, I think. What we've done to them, too, as parents and a society, I think, if I could throw this out and expect not everybody to agree with me, which is more fun. It's what we do in the humanities is try to get people to disagree constructively and safely, is that we've raised what I'd say is a very safety-conscious generation of kids, the ones we've got right now. One of the ways they're different from my generation, which was more, as a generalization, more of a risk-taking generation. These are very safety-oriented kids. But I think they want to cover every base, you know, so if they can do that with three majors rather than two majors, if they can do it with four different things mm-hmm. rather than two different things, they want to do all of that. But one of the downsides of that, it seems to me, is it's much harder to get them to put both feet into anything. So we have this kind of measured thing. I'm going to do a little bit of that, a little bit of that, and I want to make sure I get a job and all of that. I actually think they're wrong about safety, safety comes in doing what you're best at, what you most enjoy, what Joan was just saying, what you were just saying, about being happy and having a passion for what you're doing. What you don't want to do is look back with regret. I know guys my own age, very successful in their careers, doctors, lawyers, other professionals, who now look back and say, you know, I wish I had done whatever it is I really wanted to do. And that's where you don't want to be when you're 60 years old. You don't want to be looking back with regret.
Well, let me get to the phones. Mike in Livonia. Oh, we've lost Mike. Mike in Livonia, we lost you. Call us back. Gary in Rochester. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, thanks, Evan. First of all, I just want to compliment you on your first hour. That was an excellent show, Professor Lawrence. Thank you for doing that.
Sure.
And secondly, Professor Slaughter, I read your book, Independence. I sent you an email about it, as a matter of fact, and I've since loaned it to a professional historian who likes it very much. I think one of the best things about your book is it shows, and maybe you could talk about this a little bit more, but the complexities of situations. And when we speak about the causes of the revolution, and everyone seems to say just taxes, but how much more complex it was than that. And I do appreciate what you're saying about the students you get. And in an earlier program this week, this also came up about history and political science. But what I'm wondering is we've seen, and as the other guest has mentioned, we seem to have lost touch with the importance in the general population of the meaning and the gifts that the classics give us. I'm sure in your studies you've read, you know, the Constitutional Convention debates, and you'll hear time and again that these soldiers, merchants, and farmers were constantly referring to the classics in a way that I think modern politicians couldn't follow. So my question is, how do we get the general population and the public school population, or through the public schools, to begin to appreciate the humanities, history, and that these things, so that when they get to your level, and in, again, in the general population, there's more of an appreciation for this. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Gary. Great question. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, Gary, that's a terrific question. It seems to me that one of the crises that the humanities has gone through in my adulthood is an internal crisis in confidence, because you're right. Back in the 1960s, as Evan was saying, when the humanities reached a peak of popularity, there was an established canon, the literature that we agreed everybody should read. And what happened in the 70s and 80s and 90s is that we exploded that canon. And what we haven't done is substituted another one for it, which is good. But as a result, we don't have a core set of shared texts the way we used to do. We have a much broader array of possible classics that you should engage, that you should have an awareness of. And so that exhibits itself, I think, sometimes in some ways in public schools, which are very much politicized by the states that run them and fund them, by a set of values that are no longer shared and are much broader than they used to be. So how do we begin to change that? I do think you're absolutely right that we need to adapt, we need to accommodate. In that book of mine that you're referring to that came out last summer, I say in the in the acknowledgments that this is based on me teaching the American Revolution for 30 years. This is the way I came to tell the story and what I appreciated as both its full complexity, but at the same time in a way that was comprehensible, embraceable by students who had very little or no background in it. And that's one of the things we have to do. And one of the other things we have to do in adapting to change, the humanities has always had to adapt to change. Our first thing we had to adapt to was the printing press. And then we have to adapt to the fountain pen. And then we have to adapt to the typewriter. And then we have to, and now both Joan and I are engaged in adapting to the computer. How do the humanities adapt to the computer? How do we teach the sort of tool use with the computer that can fulfill the ambitions of the humanities? And that's one of the things that we have to be doing, and along with, as a support for, teaching critical thinking, teaching literacy, teaching how to articulate your own ideas.
But Joan, I think I've got a three-year-old. I want him to grow up a good eater. So we don't eat fast food in front of him, and he doesn't eat much fast food. I want him to grow up loving all forms of music. So, yes, occasionally there's some Taylor Swift in the house, but there's also Mozart and Beethoven and Schumann and all these things. But if you want him to appreciate the classics, don't you have to model it as parents? I mean, we can't just get to high school and hope that kids will start appreciating the classics in a classroom setting, because then they're often going to roll their eyes. Somehow we've got to find a way to model it better, I think, at a younger age.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that there is, among certain segments of the population, a sort of pervasive distrust of educated people. I mean, I think that your child is extremely lucky, because already at age 3, he is being exposed to all sorts of things. And I try to do that too. I try to take my children, you know, since they've been young, they've taken classes at the Memorial Art Gallery, they've been to galleries, they've been to plays, they've been to symphonies, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's only so much that we can do as parents. And I think that you're right. It absolutely begins at home. But I think that if you live in an environment where those things aren't available to you, and maybe you haven't gone to college, and maybe you don't have exposure to these things, you can't be expected then to teach them to your children. And I think, I don't want to say that it's a crisis in the public schools, but it does, part of it, you know, my kids go to a fabulous school here in Rochester, and so I feel like they're being exposed to all sorts of things in school. But I do think that it's much more pervasive, and I think that this idea that, you know, somehow or another, the sort of educated citizen is somehow
elitist.
Elitist, yeah, has become a common refrain. So that, you know, there, you know, the ancient Greeks and through, you know, the 20th century, you know, people like John Dewey saw rational critical debate as crucial to the sort of functioning democracy. But that you need to be rational and you need to be engaged and you need to be informed. And so this idea that, I mean, there's a real tension, I think, between what we know and how we teach others with it, and you have to be sort of careful not to alienate people,
yeah,
who don't have the same educational backgrounds.
I think that's fair, but I also don't understand why elitist is a bad. I would like elite doctors doing my heart surgery.
Exactly.
I would like an elite pilot flying my plane. let me get back to the phones. Sherman in Rochester. Go ahead, Sherman.
I just got a quick comment. My girlfriend is an English teacher in the Rochester area, and you know, she went to school, got an English education degree, and then a master's in literature. And I have a background in science, but I've also taken many humanities courses with my degree. And I find that when we have discussions, those discussions are not necessarily you know, they're not as plain as some other discussions that we hear some of our friends saying. And not to say that our friends are dumb, but...
See, we just talked about this, Sherman. We just talked about elitism. No, I kid.
But,
go ahead.
And they're very smart people themselves, but they don't have a background as enriched as we do in different humanities. And I feel like their discussions end a lot sooner than my girlfriend and I. And I think that we have richer, like, discourse. If we disagree with something, we can back our arguments up, and we can actually help each other see our points of view better. And I think that definitely enriches our relationship. So that's just my comment I have. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Sherman.
I have great hope for their relationship. But this isn't the right show for that, is it?
No, it's different. Joan, that didn't. You know, I take the point he's making. I mean, some people would say it sounds elitist, but he's saying that has enriched their relationship, their discussions, their conversations. I don't think that's a negative.
No, I don't either. I mean, I'm an art history professor. It's hard to get more rarefied than that, right? Yes, I think actually my heart sort of swelled when I was listening to Sherman talk about his relationship and the conversations that they have, because I've been in those same situations myself where, you know, I listen to my students or even my own children, and they're engaged, they're countering with, you know, really great examples, and I think, okay, this is a success. So,
but what about, and let me at least try. Wow, the phone's just lit up. Look what you guys have done. Look at all this interest in the humanities. It's great. We're going to get to as many phone calls as we can this hour. But what about, very realistically, we've talked about in the 1960s, humanities kind of peaked in terms of enrollment, maybe 17% or so. The 1980s, we saw it fall to around 7%. And I think Jones is exactly right for a lot of logical reasons. It's great, especially to see a diversification of options for women. I mean, we've talked on this program. Ruth Scott, this amazing pioneering woman in Rochester history, went to college in the 1950s as a black woman and was told, you need to get into teaching because that's really all there is for you. And by the way, it should be elementary. I mean, that's how much things have changed. So that's good. But there... So now that you have more options available to people, you still have to think about, for me, the biggest difference from the 1980s or the 1960s, especially today, which is the cost of education. And higher education is expensive. You know, very few students pay a full ride price at the University of Rochester, but for those that do, they're paying around $60,000 a year. Even if you're getting help, it may be around $40,000 or $35,000 or $30,000. It's a lot of money. And you do want to feel like that degree is going to yield you something that will, number one, help you clear out any loan debt and then create a sustainable lifestyle. And artists especially really struggle with it. We hear about them all the time. They're constantly being told, I really love, let's say you paint, I love this piece. I'd love to put it on display, but I can't pay you. But wouldn't that exposure be great? Say you're in music. Well, could you donate such and such? It's hard, especially for some parts of the humanities, to make good livings, is it not, Tom?
Has it ever been any easier or any harder to make a living as an artist or musician? Those are two of the really, really always rough Without somebody supporting you and so without a patron going back forever, I just don't know how you would begin to make sensible comparisons between now and any other points in history for those particular careers. Plus, I'm also really, really stuck on your three-year-old because it reminds me very fondly, nostalgically, somewhat melancholically about our great hopes when we had a three-year-old that we could somehow affect their diet and behavior and culture. And now that my kid's in their early 20s and my son eats, as near as I can tell, only pizza, I feel like an utter and complete failure. Well, I wouldn't get all my eggs in the basket of thinking that you've got a major influence on your kid in relationship to the larger culture. Good, go for it. I'd do it the same way all over again. But our notion is that somehow we could address a range of problems that we foresaw on the horizon for our kids gives a even greater depth to the questions for me, the questions you're already addressing about our relationship to the larger culture and other changes and trends in the culture that we can observe, we can try to adjust to, we can even try to accommodate, but in fact, it's like the tides in the ocean. You know, you want to know how to swim and you want to know how to float and hope you don't get hit by a riptide, but, you know, there's only so much we can do.
But, Joan, when I think of especially the starving artists, Tom's right. That's been a classic throughout history. Most artists starve for a while. Hopefully not really, but, you know, it's hard. Yeah, it's always been hard in certain areas to make a living, to find an audience, to get paid for your work, art, music, etc. Again, the difference now is for those who would pursue a degree, it's on a scale of expense, it's different now. And it's a harder sell, I think, for students now.
I think that you've absolutely hit the nail on the head, that the real crisis, I don't think, is really about the humanities. It's about how much education costs. And if you're going to take on colossal amounts of debt, you want to, as you say, at least think that there's a possibility of repaying it. Ironically, though, I will say, as somebody who oversees both an art and an art history department, our studio art majors tend to graduate with skills. And I'm not saying that our art history majors don't graduate with skills, because they do. They're
skills that translate to jobs.
That translate to jobs, because they have portfolios and they can do design work and they can, you know, they come out knowing how to use lots of different computer programs and Photoshop and digital imaging and all sorts of things that actually do translate into both a creative practice as well as, you know, lines on a CV. So maybe that's changing. Maybe it's going to be the employed artist and the starving art historian going forward. But I do think that, you know, there's some interesting programs that we're working on with, you know, medical students based on art, the observation and learning how to look and learning how to translate what you see into words and communicate that so that, you know, I've been in conversation with people in the med school about having special classes for pre-med students looking at paintings and, you know, what is it that you see there? Now tell me about that. And then using that as, you know, training for sort of bedside manner. So there are interesting types of skills that you may not think of as skills that one learns in humanities classes. But in terms of the starving artists and starving musicians, I agree. This is a trope. It's become a stereotype. But I do think that going forward, at least within my department, our art studio art majors tend to have pretty successful job employment rates.
I am way late for a break. Every single phone line's lit up. Let's take the shortest break we can and come right back. Your phone calls as we talk about the humanities with Professors Thomas Slaughter and Joan Saab from University of Rochester. Joan's professor of art history. Tom is the professor of history who is the author of a book called Independence, The Tangled Roots of the American Revolution that we covered last year. Your phone calls as we talk humanities next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, you might have seen a recent New York Times headline, an opinion piece that declared, you shouldn't let your children grow up to be farmers. Why is that? what's wrong with being a farmer? In fact, we talked to some young farmers, farmers in their 20s and 30s, who chose this career over many other opportunities. Meet them Monday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Bond, Schenick & King, a full-service law firm with 11 offices serving companies, not-for-profits, municipalities, and individuals in New York State and nationally. More at bsk.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get back to the phones. Mike in Livonia. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, hi. So it's interesting when you gave the statistic about how humanity started to drop off in the 1970. And I'm a really economics-focused kind of guy and wonder, is economics part of the humanities spectrum? But in studying economics, I've kind of found that humanities is economics and economics is humanities because nobody can do anything unless they find a job and earn something of some sort of wealth to support themselves. And has there been like a disconnect thinking that somehow the thought about economics is like this separate thing that needs to be focused with accounting and brokerages and banks? But I mean, maybe that's what humanities does, is show us how everything is connected. And if you don't learn about everything, then you're missing something.
Professor Slaughter?
When I've worked with corporate recruiters, both at Rutgers, where I taught for a long time, and at Notre Dame, where I was the 7 years before the 7 years I've been here, I heard the same thing over and over again. They said, give me an English major or a philosophy major or a history major who can communicate, who can write memos or instructions that other people will understand, who can speak articulately in the workplace. I'll take them every time. I'll take that person every time. And if I want them to learn some aspect of the business, I'll pay for them to go get an MBA. But what we need are people with the communication skills. So I actually think in trying to be safe, students are often dead wrong about the marketplace, that they are developing absolutely essential skills no matter what career they're going to pursue, by learning how to learning greater literacy and to be more articulate people, and to learn how to think critically and communicate to group conversations about planning and execution and design. And so I'm not at all sure that the safe path for all students is in any particular career, which in any one year might have a statistical blip in the number of hirings.
Mike, go ahead. What do you think? Are you there, Mike? Oh, okay. We've lost Mike, but let me let Joan jump in there. And go ahead, Joan. I take Mike's concern the same way a lot of people look at the field. Again, we've been talking about income. What do you say?
Well, I agree that we do have to think about livelihood and the idea that, you know, one should, you know, live in some kind of, you know, Pollyanna world where it's not, you have to be practical. But I think I've heard similar stories to the one that Tom just talked about from people who say, I'd rather train people to be on my business model, but have somebody come in who is thoughtful and has a sense of how to communicate ideas and solve problems and think critically. So I do think that these things have to happen in a balanced way.
Okay, let me get back to the phones. And we have Tim in Pittsford. Tim, go ahead.
Hey, Evan. I jumped in way late on this conversation, but I was lucky enough to hear Sherman's call. I wasn't sure whether to laugh or to have my blood boil, because it puts average people like me, it puts us off, because I'm guessing he doesn't have kids yet, because all the enriching conversations you have before kids kind of goes bye-bye when kids show up. Some of the conversations my wife and I have with our kids, I think about it 2 minutes later and like, did those words just come out of my mouth? I feel dumber by the minute, but it's funny. It's funny to me. But in the end, we try and expose our kids to everything we possibly can, and we think it's good for them. Well, you know what? Kids are kids. They want to play with Legos. They want to watch Frozen. They want to go outside.
That's kind of what Tom told me. Yeah, Tom warned me about that, too. And Tim, you and I have kids around the same age, I think. So, yeah, I think you're right about that.
Yeah, but I just, you know, it's hard to hear from other people saying, you know, we're having more enriched conversations. Well, maybe they're more enriched to you, and you think that, but there's a lot of other factors that go into this. Your environment is going to produce whatever conversation a couple 3-year-olds and a 6-year-old, make that conversation go in their direction, basically. And there's maybe he'll learn that the enriching conversations are going to be few and far between for a while.
Most of my conversations are about Thomas the Train these days, Tim.
That's basically me too. That are ones when we watch the Lego movie.
Yeah, Thomas the Tank Engine or Chuggington or any of the ilk of the trains.
Yeah.
But Tim, I take it that you're not really buying the notion that humanities gives you sort of enriches your ability to look at life in different ways, even if you apply it to different careers or settings.
Well, I think it does, but I don't need. I shouldn't say I don't need. It sounds like preaching and belittling sometimes. And I know you mentioned it before about elite, and I have a hard time with it. I mean, my wife is well educated; she went to the U of R, but I think. If you've got an open mind, I'm open to pretty much everything, but I'm a realist too. And if my kid goes to the U of R, you know what, you better come out a doctor. I'm just going to be serious about this because I ain't paying off your debt when I'm 40-something years old like I still am now in my 30s for my wife. But that's just the reality of it. And if you could pick up, if you want to take humanities and become more worldly, then that's great. I have no objections to that at all.
Well, before I kick it over to Joan, Tim, let me just I hope that you sense that my view as the host of this program, obviously we've got a great relationship with the local universities, University of Rochester, but you do hear me trying to represent those kind of concerns. I mean, they are real. Loan debt is real.
I've said before, I applaud you because you've always had people on saying, well, you're not really paying the $60,000. And you said, well, you're still paying $40,000,
okay.
Even if you're not rich. I'll hang off of it. I'm taking too much of your time.
Thank you, Tim. Sherman touched a nerve with Tim. But Joan, I know you want to jump in there. Go ahead.
Well, I have two boys, and I spend a lot of time watching Thomas the Tank Engine cartoons. And they're actually really interesting because they're all about utility, right? They're all about the usefulness in Tom and the Thomas the cheeky little engine who sort of breaks the model of the useful.
But isn't that kind of anti-human? It's amazing revving a Thomas the Tank Engine.
I know,
engine
this is
discussion.
Why I brought it up.
But isn't it sort of absolutely anti-humanity? You have to have accomplished 10 things in a day for the dictator, or they called him the fat controller, Sir Topham Hatt, to decide that you've been useful.
Mm-hmm.
You can't daydream and write a song if you're Percy. You've got to pull the mail to every last place on that island. And, it's not very humanity.
So you're teaching your kids to critique capitalism.
See, but this is my point. That's what I was going to say. You can have, conversations around Thomas the Tank Engine. And I remember having them with my own children around utility and singing and Percy and Thomas and et cetera, et cetera. So I do think that there are places within, you don't have to be Sherman and his girlfriend. You can be, Tim and his 6-year-old. But I also think that there is a place for the educated doctor. My father is a doctor, and he was a history major. And he went to a small liberal arts college, and he took all of his pre-med, courses. But he also came out of college as a history major. So I do think that there are ways to combine these things so that it's not an either-or situation. And I'm not saying that I think the humanities should be a service to the other professions, but I do think that there's places, as one of the other callers said, for everything, whether you're an economist or you're a physician, to have a sense of how all of these things are related to one another. And that's what the humanities can teach us.
All right. I got to get back to the phone. Tom, you want a brief comment on that?
Well, I'm not even confident that people have the economics of this right. I mean, saying if I'm going to pay for my kid to go to college, I want them to come out a doctor.
He's not saying any college. He's saying the top end of the spectrum.
An expensive college. I want my kid to come out being a doctor. I would like to interrogate why a doctor, because of the prestige, because of the money.
The money. They don't make he doesn't as money. Want decades of loan debt.
They don't make as much money in relationship to other professions as they used to, and they aren't. It's not the same profession that it used to be. So I think that's old information, really. I don't think that's the greatest economic ambition to have for your kid. And why would you want a miserable doctor? I've had miserable doctors. You know, I want to prescribe antidepressants for one of my doctors. I mean, you know, you need to find something that fits and suits you, and you'll be successful at it. That's what you should want for your kid, it seems to me.
All right, let me get back to the phones. Kurt in Middlesex has been waiting. Go ahead, Kurt.
Hi, Evan. Yeah, I wanted to sort of share my own personal humanities origin story to give some context. I started as a chemistry major in college in the 80s, and in my fourth semester took a required literature class of all majors, and at the end of the semester, taking the essay final, writing about Herman Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener, I kind of had the deep, profound insight in that moment that this was, as they say, speaking to me about my condition, the human condition. And I immediately sort of recognized that it was in this study that I wasn't getting in my chemistry track that was going to provide me these tools for self-knowledge and self-awareness, and that was what I needed to do. And so went to the dean, changed my major, and the rest is history.
Joan?
Bartleby is a funny, you know, I would prefer not to. Isn't that his famous line?
Yep.
Yeah. So what are you doing now?
I teach in the humanities.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, I do think sometimes this happens with students that I have. They come in, they have to take a course to, you know, we have a cluster system. I teach a lot of architectural history courses, so I often have a lot of engineers who come in, and they'll take an architectural history class, and they'll have this sort of eureka moment, very similar to what you've described. You know, these buildings actually have uses, one said to me one time, like, wow, I really was thinking of them as mathematical problems, but now I see that people experience the space and they're about bodies moving through space, and it's a really, for me, satisfying moment. And I'm not trying to, you know, tell these students to no longer be engineers, but to balance their engineering with this humanistic inquiry into architectural history so that they do at least have a sense of the uses of the buildings and things and the structures that they're putting together.
Well, thanks for the call, Kurt. I appreciate it. Let me grab one more phone call, and that is going to be Carlene in Rochester. Go ahead, Carlene.
Hi. I'm very appreciative of the classics, but I'm reading an interesting book that was written in 1884, and it's written by someone who did a classic collection for children, and there was a movement back then. The head of Harvard and some other universities and other educators were behind it, and they were put together a group of books, this one happens to be Lady of the Lake, for elementary students, and they're well written, very fairly priced, extremely vivid pictures. And what they're saying here is that in that day, 25 out of 25 students, maybe only one of them, would make it to high school. And so now we have the problems of dropouts, et cetera. But what was interesting, they were directing this wonderful literature that they handpicked to 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, and 12-year-olds. So what they would have is in the book, they would have these wonderful lines, and at the bottom of the page, they would have definitions of the word, because they said, who in the world at 9 years old owns a dictionary? Well, now, of course, they'll own an iPad and a spell checker. So where I am with this is it's fabulous that they want to rekindle interest at the college level, but you must start much, much earlier, not as early as Thomas, et cetera, but the early elementary days. And without a curriculum that just doesn't focus on rote and the repetition of things, without English and literature of that will appeal to children, you're not stirring the fires or the embers of the fire. And anyhow, this the president of Harvard was in this group, and there were a number of dignitaries I could mention. But the thing is, this is 1884, and here we are again.
Well, thanks for the call, Carlene. We're going to run out of time. Tom, some brief thoughts there?
Well, that's Sir Walter Scott, and the Digital Humanities Project that I'm working on now with the Sewards, they've got this family has a 7,000-plus volume personal library. The teenage daughter has a personal library of 350 books, and they are looking constantly. The mother educates the kids when they're very small before they go on to school outside the home, and she's constantly looking for books, some of which are adapted as the book that Carlene's talking about for a young adult or younger audience, because you want to have great literature for the 9-year-old and the 11-year-old and the 13-year-old as they're moving up. And I think we still try to do that, and I think there's a lot of resources available to do that, and the public libraries in this area are very supportive of that endeavor, and I absolutely agree. It's essential.
Well,
and there, Evan's going to have much greater effect on his kids than he is.
See, Tom, I will say we'll let the audience decide, but I think that you have handled the interrogation as well as you could this hour. I think the humanities are right where they've been for a while, and it's been a fascinating discussion with Tom Slaughter, professor of history at the University of Rochester, and Joan, professor of art history. I guess we look at the number of calls. I guess we should talk humanities more often, it turns out, Joan.
We should. We definitely should.
I think people are definitely fired up about it, which is a good sign. So thanks to you both. I hope that we can come back and talk much more about the projects you're both involved with, because as much as we've talked in general terms, again, Joan's been doing some very interesting things. Will you keep us abreast of that? And I would
absolutely
love to talk about that. Yeah.
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Thanks for taking the time. And Tom, your book last summer was fabulous. Maybe we'll talk about it around July 4th again. We'll keep reminding people on the roots of independence.
Love to. You know where to find me.
And
thanks, Evan.
And we'll talk Sewards, which is always a favorite subject for me. Great way to start your weekend. I hope that you're energized, no matter how you feel about the discussion you just heard. Thanks to our guests from the University of Rochester. Thanks to John Andrus, our wonderful engineer. Thanks to Ra Ra Riot for providing the great music. See, look at a little music, a little humanities, a little modern melding there. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great weekend.